Thank you all for sticking it out through the afternoon, and thanks to the organizers. This has been a very engaging and really productive series of discussions. So the paper that I'm presenting is titled What's Wrong with the Mall, and it's subtitled Power and Publicity in Democratic Politics. And each of those two titles, the main title and the subtitle, refers to a distinct question. The mall of the main title is the post-war suburban American shopping mall. And by asking what's wrong with the mall, I'm really asking what are good reasons to be critical of the sort of spatial form that American shopping malls exemplify? And I'll say more about what I mean about that in just a moment. But the subtitle, Power and Publicity in Democratic Politics, points to a distinct but I think not unrelated question, which is the question of the value that publicity holds for democratic governance. The paper has an unconventional structure. It's basically a sandwich kind of structure, where the middle, the meat, or maybe the tofu or whatever, addresses the question of the relation between democracy and publicity, while the beginning and the end, which are the bread, are about democracy and public space. So I'm going to just present it in the somewhat unconventional way that it's written. So I'll start out with the mall, I'll move to publicity's value for democracy, and then back to the mall, and I hope it'll all sort of hang together by the time I get through. Okay, so first the mall. And so the starting point for the paper is a worry that I think preoccupies a lot of us in this room about the decline of public space and the supplanting of formerly public spaces by various forms of non-public space. And we heard examples of this yesterday morning in the presentation on Montreal's Festival Square, and even yesterday afternoon in some of the discussions of gated communities and what we sort of started calling de facto gated communities. But the main example I use is a suburban shopping mall. And what I do in the first section is I look at what I call the democratic critique of non-public space, and I'll just add parenthetically that I started out this paper as somebody who was persuaded by the democratic critique of non-public space, but I ended up not persuaded by it for reasons that I'll explain in just a moment. But first, let me just give you my sort of sketch of what I understand this critique to be. And I think that there are three main claims that comprise this critique. The first is that non-public space is simultaneously exclusionary and isolating. So non-public space is, by definition, space that is not open to everybody. It bars some people from entering. And at the same time, it necessarily shields the people whom it admits from the people who don't get in. Second, non-public space is policed space, and the important part of this is that it's policed by democratically unaccountable agents. So if you think of the mall, typically by security guards who are hired by the mall owner. And then third, non-public space is depoliticizing space, and Peggy's done really interesting work on this. And the example I think of comes from some of her work about the restrictions on the various forms of political activity in some of these kinds of spaces. And also you see this in a lot of the writing in gated communities. So for instance, prohibitions against picketing, prohibitions against leafleting. So if you ask the question I ask in my title, what's wrong with the mall, or what's wrong with the kinds of non-public space that I want to suggest the mall exemplifies, many people who endorse politically egalitarian and democratic principles will answer by offering one or more of these reasons. Non-public space is exclusionary and isolating, non-public space is policed by unaccountable agents, and non-public space is depoliticizing. And so what I try to do is suggest that at the heart of this critique lies a commitment to democratic publicity, which, following Habermas and others, I think about not as a single value so much as a family of values that includes transparency, accountability, inclusiveness, cohesion, and public political engagement. So basically, in the first section, I suggest that the democratic critique of non-public space rests on the following claim: democracy needs public space because democracy needs publicity. And of course, there's really two claims embedded in that sentence. One is an empirical claim about the causal relationship between public space and publicity. And then the other is a normative claim about publicity's democratic value. And so the middle part of the paper focuses on that second normative claim, the claim that democracy needs publicity And I think about this first by thinking about what I characterize as a classic account of publicity's democratic value, which I get from Habermas. So I'll just go very briefly over this. Unsurprisingly, I focus on structural transformation of the public sphere. And what I do is I try to capture what I think is Habermas's core insight in that book by imagining two ideal typical political processes. The first process is completely opaque. The officials are deciding political outcomes behind closed doors, and ordinary citizens have no information whatever about what's going on behind those doors. So they don't know anything about the process, the reasons given, et cetera. On top of that, the citizens themselves are segregated by perhaps class, perhaps comprehensive worldview. And then even within those segregated groups, they have no capacity whatever to communicate with one another about their political beliefs, their understandings of their interests, their needs. So they're unable to deliberate together, and they're unable to act collectively to challenge the decisions that the officials make. So in this first process, public officials are enabled to make collective decisions that promote their private good, and citizens have no recourse whatever for influencing outcomes. The second process is different. It's infused with the openness, the transparency, the inclusiveness, the horizontal ties, so the connections among the citizens, and also the public political deliberation that Habermas associates with publicity. Publicity enables the citizens to know how the officials act, to know not just how they decide, but also what reasons they give for the decisions that they make. And on top of that, the inclusiveness and the public political engagement that's associated with publicity enable them to communicate with one another. So they're able to organize, they're able to mobilize, and they're able to press critiques and claims against the officials. So in this second ideal typical process, publicity enables a body that for the moment we'll call the public to criticize the use that public officials make of power and to push them to exercise power in ways that serve what for the moment we can call the good of the public. Okay, so that's a very, very stylized presentation of the classic account of publicity's democratic value. But I think it captures an intuitively appealing and I think a pretty widely endorsed normative claim about publicity, which is that publicity enables the role that's played by intersubjective reason in making collective decisions to expand, and at the same time it reduces the role that's played by some people's capacities to coerce others, so it moves politics closer to a state in which power serves the good of all, the public good. It being the operative phrase, which is where Habermas's critics come in, who say that the obvious difficulty with such an account of publicity's democratic value, and I'll say parenthetically in case we have Habermasians in the room, that I do acknowledge in the paper, and in fact this is kind of why I pick Habermas, that this is a difficulty that he's keenly aware of. This is not something that's not grappled with in his account. But the difficulty is that there isn't a public in the sense of a unified body of citizens that's inclusive of all and that's bound together by something that gives them this sense of cohesiveness, whether it's a shared identity or shared interests or whatever. And that's why for Habermas, he underscores the what he refers to as this important tension in the bourgeois public sphere between, on the one hand, its implicit claim to be open to all and to be inclusive of all, and on the other hand, its de facto exclusions. So some critics say, well, what we need to do then is we need to think about the public differently. We need to think about it as heterogeneous. That's Iris Young's language. We need to think about multiple publics. That's Nancy Fraser. And they suggest that publicity, so openness, inclusiveness, public political engagement, doesn't actually prompt power to serve the public good so much as it prompts people to take into account the experiences and the perspectives of others. Which I think is not so different from the view that's been articulated at a couple different points in our conversations yesterday and today. And I think it's not so different from the view that's implicit in what I call the democratic critique of non-public space. Yesterday, in the presentation on the Montreal non-public space, We talked about, or the claim was articulated, that there's something about unplanned, unchosen encounters with others who are different, who are political strangers to us, which are the kinds of encounters that happen in public, but not in non-public space, such that they foster a kind of openness toward others' perspectives and claims that's necessary for democratic politics. So I find this view normatively very appealing, as I imagine most of you do. And as I said, I sort of started out leaning toward endorsing it, but I'm not persuaded by this view. And the main reason is that based on the evidence that I know, which is mostly but not exclusively from social psychology, it seems that this view rests on empirical presuppositions that the available evidence suggests are probably wrong. It doesn't seem to be the case that encountering strangers in the kinds of public spaces that urbanists, including myself, love so much, fosters openness towards others' perspectives and claims. It doesn't seem to be the case that even more robust forms of political engagement than the kind we'd have in public spaces, so public deliberation, political deliberation across difference, it doesn't seem to be the case that it necessarily does that. As others have argued, including empirical scholars of political deliberation, bringing people together to deliberate across lines of difference may well encourage a heightened perception of conflicting interests, conflicting ends, and may in fact increase tension and conflict across lines of social difference. And I think the evidence is even less compelling when we're just talking about chance encounters among strangers in public spaces. So there are other critics who suggest, well, what we need to do is just reject the ideals that are associated with publicity, inclusiveness, openness, transparency. I think this is a mistake. I don't think Democrats can afford to throw out these ideals. So what I do is I articulate an alternative to the classic view of publicity's democratic value, and I do that by using not Habermas, but Dewey of the Public and Its Problems. Where Dewey's worry, you'll remember, is a worry about what he calls the loss of the public. And we talked about this a little bit this morning as well. A parenthetical comment, I read Dewey in a very specific way in this part of the paper. And what I do is I say his important contribution in that book was to highlight what he claimed were three principal ways that power relations were changing. So this is 1927 when Dewey's writing. But I think the three changes he highlighted in that book continue to be very crucial for thinking about publicity's democratic value today. And I basically do a little violence to Dewey. I impose my own language on him. So if you want to tell me that that's not Dewey, that would be fine with me. Like, I'm happy to take credit. But it's more in the interest of full disclosure that I'm telling you that I got these ideas from him. So I basically think that he suggests three shifts in or three changes to power relations. The first is that power was increasingly impersonalized. So Dewey notes that the development of new technologies for communication, travel, production, and the expansion of capitalist markets that these new technologies enabled expanded relations of human interdependence, which he said undermined people's capacities to recognize the interest that they had in regulating what he refers to as the indirect consequences of the actions that affect them. And he says these changes undermine people's capacities to organize and to act collectively to regulate the indirect consequences of these actions that affect them. So that's change one. Power relations are increasingly impersonalized. Two, they're increasingly asymmetrical. So technological changes and changes in markets, he says, expand and impersonalize the relations through which people affect each other's actions. At the same time, they enable the concentration of economic power and the bureaucratization of political power. So if people grow increasingly unable to recognize their interests in regulating the indirect consequences of action and to organize to change those, because power relations are impersonalized, because they're increasingly asymmetrical, his claim is even if people could recognize their interests in regulating the indirect consequences of action and organize with others to change them, The authors of those actions are increasingly powerful, democratically unaccountable agents like transnational corporations or state administrative agencies or the mass media. So you can think about this first change, the impersonalization of power, as undermining people's political capacities in an absolute sense. And the second change, the increasing asymmetry of power relations, as undermining their political capacities relative to these increasingly powerful, unaccountable agents. So that's change two. And then change three is what I call the increasing polymorphism of power. Dewey's writing in 1927 in the US, and there as elsewhere, the citizenry is growing more plural in its constitution. As the citizenry expanded over the course of the century to include the unpropertied, to include women in the U.S., to include African Americans, the possibility of there existing a public that's defined by shared interests or shared values or shared identity became more and more remote. So it's not just that people can't see their interests in regulating the indirect consequences of action and are overmatched by these powerful, unaccountable actors like corporations and bureaucracies. It's also, on top of that, that even if this weren't the case, it's not clear how it would be in their interest to regulate the indirect consequences of action. So it's not clear which people should ally themselves with which others. It's not clear which collective aims they should pursue, which strategies they should pursue. So these three changes on my reading of Dewey, power's growing impersonalization and asymmetry and polymorphism, are driving what Dewey calls the loss of the public. And what I do is I use them to think about a different answer to this question of publicity's democratic value. Democracy needs publicity, I argue, to counterbalance power's impersonality, asymmetry, and polymorphism. So if you think again about the example that I started out with of the suburban shopping mall, the democratic critique of non-public space really focuses our attention on the spatial form of places like that. But a lot of what's most troubling about the development of post-war America from a democratic perspective is how non-public space gets made and how it gets remade. So the political decision-making processes through which that happens. For instance, processes that grant disproportionate power over development to private capital, or the institutions of local governance that in the US decentralize authority to politically autonomous suburbs. So these are really some of the things we've been talking about for the past 2 days. These are institutions and processes that enable people who are privileged by extant or status quo power relations, business elites, residents of affluent suburbs, to make decisions that affect the disadvantaged and to do so without engaging them politically. So they're institutions and processes that circumvent the relevant public, if we think of a public in Dewey's rather than Habermas's sense of that word. And I suggest in the end that some of the reforms that are recommended by various urbanists are publicity-enhancing reforms if we think about publicity in this Deweyan way. So an example would be prohibitions against exclusionary zoning. Another example would be some of the changes to local voting rules that we've talked about over the course of the past couple days, changes that would enable non-residents significantly affected by a decision in a municipality to vote in its elections, which I think are publicity enhancing in the sense that they promote democratic openness, political inclusiveness. They constrain people who are differently affected by collective decisions to engage one another in political contests over those decisions. The result of political contests like those would be coercive in the simple sense that the laws and the policies decided would be different from the laws and policies that at least some people desired. So if, for instance, the merger in Montreal passes, it doesn't mean that the good of the public prevails. Which is why my answer to the question of publicity's democratic value departs from what I call the classic account. Under conditions of plurality, publicity can't ensure that collective power serves all. But it can ensure that collective problems are formulated and addressed as collective problems and decided through political struggles that are open to all whom they affect. I'm almost out of time, and I just want to conclude by saying something very brief, like, you know, the second slice of bread about the relationship between public space and democracy. And basically where I come out on this question is I say, maybe democracy needs public space not because it produces some positive political good, like commonality or tolerance or openness to the claims and perspectives of others, but because it disrupts a political bad. And I think about that in a sort of suggestive way at the end of the paper about what that bad might be. And I say it might be a bad of a fantasy of an escape from power. So a fantasy that we're able to engage in non-public space of a world that's devoid of publics and their problems. And I'll just give you one little teeny excerpt from the end, and then I'll wrap up, which is that when I was reading the paper, I distracted myself by reading things that a lot of people write about mall management, like suburban mall management. And very interesting. And, you know, there's one thing I found is that there's like a real obsession in this literature of like with coming up with ways to sort of hold at bay as this kind of social disorder that wears the face of the people who are excluded. And I have a little bit of it in the paper. I'll read you a small excerpt. This is from a document called Tips for Keeping Malls Safe, which you can find on the Rutgers School of Criminal Justice website. Quote, avoid non-shopper-oriented content, such as arcade games and lottery ticket booths. Such businesses encourage loitering and increase disorder in the mall, thus opening the path for crime, end quote. Which, of course, is completely illogical, because if people are buying lottery tickets, they're shopping. They're, like, not loitering. And it's obviously not clear that buying lottery tickets or playing video games leads to crime. I especially hope this isn't the case, because my children spend all of their waking hours playing video games. But what I try to suggest at the end is that this is a kind of a fantasy that serves as a psychologically adaptive response to the impersonalization of relations of power. What it promises to do is to render power relations intelligible. So to give power a face, and in this case, it's the face of urban youth. And it basically promises to make power relations manageable through simple, concrete measures like closing video stores. And so I end by saying, I'm not certain that that's what's wrong with them all, but it seems plausible, and it seems worth exploring, because if so, it would point to an important role for public space in a democratic polity, which is disrupting a kind of a fantasy that makes enemies of political strangers and thus undermines the democratic management of power. So thanks.
So I really enjoyed your paper. I think it's very thought-provoking, because I think you pose a really important and challenging question, and that is the relationship between normative argumentation or philosophical argumentation and empirical evidence. So I have a couple of little questions for you. The first one is, I think that you correctly sort of summarize or present some compelling argument drawn from empirical studies of deliberative democracy that show, in fact, that far from resulting in anything like consensus or reason, that it results in group polarization and conflict. So given that, would you say let's get rid of the First Amendment, you know, the right to free speech? It really doesn't get us what people said it does. And if you wouldn't get rid of it, why not? That's kind of part one of my question. And then part two is, in the end, you said sort of what was really pivotal for you in rejecting your otherwise sort of sympathy for the democratic critique of non-public space is the empirical evidence against it. But I'm wondering, does it really rest on empirical evidence as much as you suggest? It seems to me that the first two of the three dimensions don't really rest on any kind of causal or consequentialist story. But let's examine the third one that perhaps does. Couldn't you make an argument in favor of public space that really didn't rest on that sort of claim at all? I have in mind here two different versions. One is an argument that Arthur Ripstein makes in his book on Kant. And from Kantian premises, he explains the need for public space. And it goes something like this. You know, in order to express my individual freedom, I have to be able to get from point A to point B. But if it's private space between those two points, I cannot move there to be in contact with other people. And so my freedom is constrained, is limited. Now, he uses that as an illustration of the need for roads or for physical public spaces. But you could also see that as being true of communication, that we need some site where we can communicate And so if you think of it in those terms, then the link between democracy also becomes more plausible, not as something which enables us to recognize one another as citizens or to be sympathetic to one another or to build solidarity, but simply to communicate with one another. And I really loved a quote that Frank Cunningham presented yesterday. I believe it was from Simmel. He said, "The function of the city is to make space for reconciliation of individual and community," or something along those lines. And I think nothing there in that says any way about what kind of reconciliation, but that it enables a kind of process. So I guess I would say, and it could be an agonistic process, it can be a process of contestation, and it can also involve misunderstanding and conflict. So I guess I would say what's wrong with the mall is that it's not that. It's not a place that makes a space for reconciliation. So as long as the mall is just one space, kind of off to the side, that's fine. But once it comes to kind of substitute and replace this alternative, then we have a real loss for democracy, regardless of whether anything approaching consensus takes place there.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Peggy and I have gone back and forth about this because we have different readings of the empirical evidence, and it's great. I really enjoy it. On the second part of the question about communication, I don't think so. And there's a part of the paper that I just didn't talk about here, but I think it's so interesting that if you read Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, which takes place in all of these very concrete places like coffee houses and salons, there's nothing internal to the logic of the argument that actually suggests that it needs to be in any kind of a physical place. And so I think in the paper I have a line where I say, and I back this up, and I do think it's a correct reading of the book, that if the internet had existed, the bourgeois public sphere could have formed itself online. Like, essentially what Habermas thinks you need is the capacity to communicate. You need the objective possibility of uncovering some kind of commonality. So in the bourgeois public sphere, it's an economic interest. And you need the critical capacities to do that. So I don't think that we need literal public spaces to communicate because there are so many other non-physical options for communicating. And I think I could communicate a message much more effectively through, online or other, even like a book or something like that.
Don't tell the SSHRC because they spent $25,000 to allow us all to come here together face-to-face in person.
Right. But I'm thinking about, but this is not a public space. I mean, this is not the kind of space that we're talking about. We're not saying that the mall and that the festival marketplace is supplanting an academic conference. We're saying it's supplanting, the spaces like the public square, the street, these are the public spaces. So I don't think those are, that the loss is one of actual communication. At the same time, I think First Amendment rights and the ability to express unpopular views are crucial, but to a contestatory view of politics. So for various reasons, including just conventional, million reasons. But that's not about an orientation toward consensus or agreement. It could be about disagreement and contest that I need the right to express even a really unpopular view. So no, I wouldn't. To the first part of your question, I agree with the spirit of it.
Okay, thank you. I'm so sorry. I have to apologize. I missed these papers, which were some of the most interesting for me. And this morning I have tenure meetings at McGill. So, but thank you. And I have a couple of quick comments and questions. I think that your case, your premise that the normative ideals are refuted in a sense, or are challenged by the empirical evidence that real encounter in real space does not necessarily create enhanced tolerance or something like that. And I'm just wondering if maybe there's the need to make more subtle, to refine, thank you, that case, say that there's maybe some kind of passive engagement with others which can be useful versus more active engagement with others. That's just a thought that popped into my head. Second thing was very interesting, that your focus was on the mall and the case that maybe we don't need physical public space. And this is one of the ideas that I sort of floated yesterday in my paper, that maybe it's not such a terrible thing if that Place des Festivals is becoming a very controlled space. I'm actually doing some work on suburban strip plazas, and I'm examining them as spaces of emergent publicity. in Toronto and Montreal, where we have very multicultural, and I know of people, I was at a conference in Long Island about a year ago, who are looking at similar things in Los Angeles, places with high proportions of Mexicans, places where there's actually a very public life in the parking lots and so on. So I wonder if you might think of, or you might agree, that the shopping mall is often used as a convenient landscape goat in our conversations around the erosion of democracy or public space. I can't take credit for that term. it was someone else. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think it's a very powerful one. Final thing is just sort of, I apologize if these are more comments than anything, but I hope that you get a chance to take a couple of pictures of the Quebec version of No Loitering, which of course is Interdit de Flâner, no flânerie allowed, because I think that's just such a wonderful inversion of some of the trope, well, an obvious trope that we use when we talk about the publicness. And I always find it interesting that in English we don't really have a very positive term for being idle or just enjoying publicity. That's about the closest we get, is, you know, this new term, the hang. Yeah. That's great. But how, you know, pejorative loitering and lollygagging are as terms.
Right. So hangout is very social, and loitering I can do alone, right?
So yes, it's
slightly
true.
Different. I think the second point, absolutely, about there, you know, there's all kinds of subversive uses that people make of shopping malls. And in the paper, I sort of anchor it with this discussion of this particular new urbanist-inspired shopping mall that won, like, the Innovative Mall Designers Award, which is in Easton, outside of Columbus, Ohio. And I could easily, the problem is that the paper is like a crazy sprawling mess, right? So I can't add more of this to it. You know, it's almost silly that I have this small thing in the beginning. But if I were going to, like, even be more, even, you know, show greater disregard for the structure of academic papers, I could add in that. So this was a super controlled mall, and they had this code of conduct that I put in the paper, and I quoted newspaper articles where these kids were like, well, we were just going from one store to the other, and they, like, detained us from loitering. So it's a very strong effort to control social disorder, but it was subverted because all of these, you know, inner city kids came to this suburban. So I think absolutely that's right. But what I'm trying to do is to say, I want a sort of stylized representation of all the things we worry about when we worry about non-public space. So to the extent that that's not really what malls are, it's kind of fine. Like, it's kind of like my stylized Habermas example isn't really how any decision-making process goes. But on passive engagement, I think I really disagree because, and again, Peggy and I have discussed this, but my understanding of this literature, which goes back to Gordon Allport, is that the kinds of engagement in which you get the kinds of effects we're all wishing that you would get in public spaces are very targeted, structured forms of engagement in which people engage in cooperative problem solving in a context in which stereotypes are explicitly refuted, et cetera. There's like five different criteria, and the five different criteria are like the description of what cities are not. You know, it's like what we don't do when we have fleeting encounters with strangers who seem superficially different to us in public space. So I do think we need public spaces, but I think we need them for a different reason, and we can't overload them and expect from them a solution to all of the problems that we face. Exactly.
Yeah, right.
And I still think we need them. Yeah. I still think there's value, like, for me, as someone who is, like, you know, a left liberal person, I think there's value to me having to walk by a protest by pro-life people. Like, I think there's value to having someone you really disagree with disrupt your fantasy that everyone agrees with you, you know, which in a space like this, you can keep alive. You think everyone agrees with you. Right. Yeah, right.
Just an anecdote. I can't resist this anecdote. There's a part of town which was already talked about yesterday called Côte Saint-Luc, which is populated by mostly a figure that was quoted yesterday. I don't know if the person is here. It was like 85% senior citizen, mostly Jewish senior citizens. I found staggering, but it is a lot of them. And you know, it gets cold in Montreal, and so there are two malls that basically have become the places where old Jewish men and women go to walk around and kibitz, and buy lottery. So, and both both of them are on the verge of bankruptcy. And actually, one of them, half of it, I drove by there the other day, half of it was actually razed to the ground. And it's only now half a mall because, you know, basically people would go there at 9 o'clock in the morning, buy a cup of coffee at Dunkin' Donuts. Maybe if they were feeling crazy, they'd buy a lottery ticket, you know, around noon. But they'd go back to their condo at 5. And, you know, it served a very important function, even physically, you know, because you can't walk when you're 85 years old and it's minus 30 outside. You know, you can't do any physical exercise. They'd walk back and forth. They wouldn't buy anything. But, you know, so I'm just thinking about, you know, they're the kind of, you know, the people. If we were to write a thing in Montreal, like your sort of tips for the mall, you know, we'd be warning them against old Jewish men. The point I wanted to, and this is, again, more of a comment, is there's another place, I don't know, anything's been written about this. There's a master's student at University of Montreal who's written about a place which is just east of the place that Nick talked about, which is Place Émile Gamelin, which is in a part of town. It's downtown. It's a part of town where a lot of sort of, you know, people wouldn't go there. It's kind of a little bit sketchy, as sketchy gets in Montreal, which isn't very sketchy, in the evenings. They decided to build a square, which was kind of like, you know, a place where people, where the hope of the planners was, we're going to build a square where people will congregate and they'll get over their fears about, you know, the others. And so the student that I that wrote this thesis under my supervision did a sort of observation thing where she noticed, I mean, it's an open space, it's completely open space. People kind of will, whereas it would be efficient to walk across it to get from A to B, people will actually avoid it, they'll walk around it. And so, you know, there's this kind of sort of Sisyphean task or mercurial attempt at, you know, organizing space where people will do stuff that is kind of, you know, where they'll kibitz and, you know, people will kibitz where they want to kibitz. People will you know, congregate where they want to congregate. And there's something kind of counterproductive about the state or, you know, planners deciding, we will build a space where this will, you know, this valuable social stuff will happen. Because in my experience, it almost never works. And people will take over spaces. The example that comes to mind is the square in front of Place Georges Pompidou in Paris. I don't know if people know it. You know, when it was this, I don't know if you know the building. It's when it was, I won't go into the building, but it was a point that was made yesterday in respect to Nick's paper, is the public is sort of unpredictable, right? I think it is important. I think there's something good for people in exactly the way that you say, getting you out of your comfort zone, getting you to just sort of appreciate, even if it is to, you know, sort of condemn it, the variety of people that surround you in your life. But the places where that's going to happen are the places where, you know, you would go to do other things rather than the places where people plan for you to do that, you know. So that was really, really incoherent and rambling. But it seems to me that public space is important, but it's important that, you know, public authorities not think that they are the ones that can design public space in which people will go out and be public with one another.
Right. And that last comment sort of reminds me of something that I had actually forgotten, which is why I didn't include it in the presentation, but it's in the paper, is that what's particularly noxious about the mall that I use as my example is it tries to, and this is really common, this is like, you know, Disneyland, it's all these places, it tries to recreate an artificial semblance of that kind of public space, but one that's completely sanitized and safe, so that you can have the happy feeling of being in the public, but it's also patrolled and there's no nasty loitering, you know, youth or senior citizens, or I guess in your case.
That's nice. I wouldn't mind actually going to a session which was just you and Peggy for about 45 minutes having at it, because you both know a lot about the malls, have thought about it philosophically too. It's really great. Just a little note.
We get some great deals when we're doing our research.
I'm sure of it. Ray, the Public and the Problems, on my reading of the book, and it could be wrong, I think you can take credit for you instead of Dewey, can take credit for half of what you attributed to him.
Right, that might be
and
right.
And we can talk about that another time. Two quick anecdotes and then my main question about more about malls. In Toronto, downtown, there's a mall which was appropriated not by elderly Jewish people but by elderly Chinese women. And they would come there every morning after they dropped the kids off at daycare or wherever they were taking them, and they would take over this mall. And at first, the owners of the mall were upset about this, but they didn't want to be seen as, you know, mall ejects, you know, College Park Mall ejects Chinese grandmothers. Later, however, they realized there was an advantage to it. It meant they were only there in the morning. They would leave before the lunch hour so that the workers, you know, close to the mall and so on, it's in an office building, would still be able to get seats. And it filled up the mall in the morning. They didn't buy anything. They even brought their own tea. But they were at least there, you know, there was some life to the place. Second anecdote, there was a philosopher from St. Mary's College in Nova Scotia who for a long time, and maybe still, I'm not sure of it, went, or maybe still goes, to a mall outside, in just on the outskirts of Halifax, with a big sign on a post, you know, on a stand that he puts up, which says, "The philosopher is in." And then people would come and talk philosophy. And initially, the mall guards wanted to kick him out, thinking him like, let's face it, folks, many of us are thought of by the public as a kook. But, you know, the people who came wouldn't let them do it. He said, "No, we want to hear. We like this. It's a regular part of our Saturday routine." It went on for years. It was really, he had a group. They talked philosophy. Sometimes it got even into social and political issues. Anyway, just stories. You know, I'm trying to remember his name. No. It might come to me. But you know, I warned you all about my synapses yesterday. Here's my question. I'm wondering whether you've come to grips with Benjamin Barber's article on mauled and something like that. Barber, I rather was persuaded by that article. On the one hand, the value that he sees in public spaces generally, I think, is closer to your view than it is to the Habermasian one. But he thinks that malls can be made to do this. And not only that, he has a case study of a mall outside Los Angeles, and he said there were other examples, I didn't pursue it, where it was actually made to do these things. It had to do with relax, all the things that you said had to be, that need to be relaxed, the security and all the rest of it. A big thing was to put the clocks back in the mall. See, in all malls, the first thing they do when they build a mall, they will not put a clock in it. They don't want people to know what time it is. They want them to get lost in the mall and keep shopping to death. So he put the clocks back in. He made sure that they made sure there were spaces. They relaxed all these rules. Now, the reason that he was doing this the reason he was advocating trying to make malls public space friendly, wasn't that he loved the malls, wasn't because he didn't see the downside of it. It was because he correctly observed that for an enormous number of people in North America, and especially younger people, the mall is about the only access that they have, or potential access, to a public space. So like it or hate it, there it is. And so better to try and ameliorate its negative dimensions and take advantage of this space than to rail against it.
I know the article. Yeah, I know the article. It's right, and it's a pun. It's like mall and M-A-U-L. Yeah, I know that article, and I remember when you talked about it yesterday thinking that I didn't remember, like, the particular. I remember I wrote down a note when you talked about it yesterday, and I don't even remember whether I cited it in the paper or not. But, yeah. However, yeah, so I guess I would say that all sounds fine, but I guess that when I think about the issues of them, like, so in the paper I try to emphasize that the focus would be more productively on institutions and processes than on actually kind of getting spaces right. So first of all, I guess I'm a little skeptical that many malls are going to want to be more public space like generally there is, I mean, not generally, always, there's a profit motive and there's a mall owner. And these people, like in the city that I was studying, there were like two major, like these are big corporations and they're trying to make money and rent out their space. So I don't think they have an agenda of trying to do this. But even if they did, I mean, I guess that I would think that that was a little bit of a Band-Aid and that it would be better, we'd be better off democratizing, like, for instance, the processes by which we decide where to site malls. And I think that's the kind of example that I give in the paper. I could take a look at the article again.
So I had two thoughts as you were speaking about this. The first was Jane Jacobs' Eyes on the Street, and the assumption seems to be that public space is a place of kind of tolerance and somewhat disordered, or at least more disordered than private space. But when you read Jane Jacobs' Eyes on the Street, the working sidewalk in the city is in fact primarily an instrument of social control. That is, it's the most effective mechanism of solving the problem of social disorder, because as she says, there's just not enough police, and the working sidewalk does this. That is, she inverts, I think, one of these assumptions, which is that, well, public space is worse at doing this than private space. And it turns out, I think, that the mall, for example, is actually quite bad at doing this for this very reason, and so they have to bring in cops and rules and various other things that the working sidewalk is better at. And maybe the flaw in the mall, or the flaw for democratic theory, is that in the mall you've abandoned your public role as one of these eyes on the street, right, which you have in the, and so in fact your public role is not a speech role at all on the sidewalk, but on a Jacobsonian theory, it's your public role is as a social controller, that is to take care of, to assert norms, and you've abandoned that in the mall. So that's the real democratic deficiency of that form of space. And then the other thing that I was thinking about while you were talking was Tahrir Square in Cairo, and whether you could have such a thing in a mall. That is such a gathering that would generate a revolution of that sort. And then I was trying to think, why do we need Tahrir Square in our cities, in our suburbs, in our places, and why it would be that place, which is could be controlled right by the military forces and the police forces of Egypt quite easily, why it is that kind of place becomes a locus of democratic action. And I think part of it is the public-private line is well defined there, which is the square is publicly owned, and so there's one less claim that you have to make to take it over as a group of people. Whereas the mall, privately owned or privately owned space in general, there's two claims you have to make. You have to make the claim to get over the private property assertion, and then you got to make the free speech claim on top of it, and that's maybe just one leap too far.
I too find this idea of valuing the public and public space for what it prevents rather than providing some good really attractive. And I guess I just, as I was, and a part of this you've heard from me before, but I'll throw it out anyway because it's, I guess, a slightly new spin. I can think of two other rationales for coming to that same conclusion, and I guess I just am wondering if you see them as consonant with your take on Dewey, or whether you would see that kind of alliance as really weird and unsettling. So the first is a Republican rationale that the good of being out in public and having those fantasies disrupted, and having the injuries of class unhidden right there in front of you, is precisely that it reminds us that, all of us as citizens, as equally sort of subjects and authors of the law together, often might share very little else, but that's democracy, that's being a citizen. And that the problem with the mall and with any space that's regulated the way the mall is, or Place du Festival, or any virtual space that was regulated in those ways, is that there is in essence a private sovereign imposing regulations on us that don't respect us as citizens in that way. So there's this Republican justification that I'm wondering what the relationship is between that and the Deweyan reading. And the second is a kind of Lefebvrean, Marxist sort of reading, is the one characteristic of a lot of public spaces, especially in cities, and sort of David Harvey, early in Social Justice in the City, makes this point, is that there are so many use values that we can sort of integrate into the same physical space, and that when we regulate that space in the way that we do in a mall, we tend to emphasize exchange values in such a way that it becomes prohibitive to practice many of those use values that before were so essential. And so if you think what's attractive about those spaces is that they allow all these multiple uses in differing ways, often very conflictual, and yet there they are, the park walker, the chess player, the hippie guitarist, the protester. If you think that's important, then the problem with privatizing those spaces and controlling them in that way is precisely that they sort of emphasize certain values in exchange rather than this plethora of use values.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, these are all good questions. I'll try to remember them. I wrote very enigmatic, sort of illegible scrawls, and I'll try to remind me of the questions. So I'll go backwards because I'm most likely to remember the most recent one. Very sympathetic to this use value issue. My oldest son no longer is, but used to be a skateboarder. And it's one of these activities that you're not allowed to do anywhere. And when the police would pick him up and phone me, I would say, well, where is he supposed to do it? Like, there's nowhere we're allowed to do it. So I'm sympathetic to it. But the question in the paper is more narrowly about the specifically democratic critique of the decline of public and its supplanting by non-public space. And so I think that's another argument. And I also think there's an aesthetic one. Like, there's all kinds of reasons to be worried about this, but I just wanted to narrow it down to, if we start from democratic principles, why should we be worried? So I agree, but I don't think that it would fit so well. If I understood the republicanism point, I would say that I don't think, again, it comes back to the empirics, but I don't think that the evidence supports the claim that encountering strangers in public space reminds me that they're my fellow citizens and I should treat them equally. I just don't think it's true. It would be nice if it did. I don't think it's true. Sorry, I'm going very quickly. The square, in terms of, I can't read anything I wrote, but basically the square and collective action, I think that the physical public space of the square is neither necessary nor sufficient to encourage collective political action. You know, and I think that it's really, like, we had that nice picture up there yesterday. It's very exciting and it's very intuitive. But I think that it wasn't just the square that did it, and I think it could have been done without the square. So I think it's neither necessary nor sufficient. And then in terms of the Jane Jacobs eyes on the street, am I the only one who finds that, like, a little creepy, like a little, like, disciplinary? So I guess I would say that the main difference between eyes on the street and, you know, getting told to move along by the mall security guard is who's exercising disciplinary power. And it's more distressing when it's the mall security guard who's doing it at the behest of the capitalist who owns the mall, because they're completely unaccountable and the motivation is a purely profit-driven motivation. But I also think it's a little distressing if it's being done by these, you know, neighbors and their motivation is to maintain dominant social norms. Like, I just don't think, I wouldn't want to be that uncritical about it. But at any rate, I'd be critical of both, and I think it's worse if it's a mall security guard.
Thank you.